Hello, and welcome to Educational Triage, where we discuss issues in alternative education. This is a discussion about teaching by teachers, for teachers, and others who are interested in the alternative education world. We hope you find today's episode relevant, engaging, and useful. And if you do, please subscribe. I'm Tony Hunt, and I'm here to help guide you with the help of my friends Christy and Philip. And today's topic is, what did we learn, if anything, from the pandemic and education? So, who would like to start us off?
I would. This is Philip.
Oh, come on, you two. Don't Aloha. Jump up and down.
Aloha. What did we learn from the pandemic, if anything? Oh, shall we count the many, many things we learned? I learned that...
Well, we're going to keep it in education there, Philip.
Kids can have two monitors going very easily, and it's easily detectable after a while, but it does take a keen eye, the two monitor thing. That was fun. Oh, what else? That was, of course, when it was online, as everyone was trying to get that started. What else was there? That was if you had everyone online, you could see their faces. Most of the programs, I remember this happening, just had a name and darkness. So you weren't sure if there was any human in that vacuum of space at all. So that was an interesting one.
Yeah. I called them bottle tops.
The guest teaching thing was interesting because depending on the policy. Although I did my long term, they were required to have the faces. That was a fun one. What else was there? Oh, and the fact that the technologically, sometimes the connections weren't good enough. Teacher talking here, and I actually had to commute to teach a remote class because I wasn't able, because of my download and upload speeds, to do the Zoom course and then run a film or do an interactive game thing. It just wouldn't work, so I had to go to the site, the school itself, and plug in and then do the class from the site because they had the great connections. Wow. So I learned those three things.
Similar that there were a lot of dots that I would teach. And so
bottle tops.
I did learn, yes, in multitasking, not always for the good, but they were super able to do that. I also learned for the good that we don't need to have a lot of meetings in person. We can definitely do a lot of them virtually.
And we don't need as many meetings as we had over that period of time, because I think that actually advanced more anxiety and stress in people, that they had to be in all these meetings and things. I don't know. But what I loved was the fact that I never realized just how stressful it was to have to take my shower, get dressed, and get to work when all I had to do was roll out of bed and just kind of, hello, everybody.
Right. Well, I learned that I could wear slippers pretty much for 18 months straight. That was good.
What really impressed me, though, was how adaptable the kids were. The ones that really wanted to go somewhere, they were incredibly adaptable. And I had kids who would do one-on-ones with my students and the two screens. Yeah, I would be speaking to one and he would never look at the screen that I was on. Hold on a second.
Your doggy.
Yeah.
Pay attention.
Stop. Okay. Okay. You guys cannot be doing this. No.
I also learned that doggies were part of many, many classrooms, including mine.
Well, mine are very, very...
The dogs, the many of them became mascots. Some of the many of the students got new puppies. And, oh, look at this. See the puppy. Yes. See the puppy. So show and tell actually returned to the classroom for a while, which I really enjoyed. Yeah. I have one of those and they brought it to the camera. No, I have a rock like that. Look, and they brought it to the camera. It was cool. Yeah.
we would do that as a way to kind of do a check-in or like a brain break. Like, everybody, you know, go get your pet or like go find something green. Or, and then like all the screens would come on, pet, 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 pet. And then it was like, okay, let's do math. And then they all turn off again. Mine. It's all good. My dogs would like leap on me and like the whole classroom would look like they were under attack. My God, what doggy is that?
That's Autumn. But Autumn. They're fighting for daddy space because, ouch. They're fighting for daddy space because I've been gone all day.
Right.
And so I came home, I played, and we had dinner, and now they're, and yeah. So I think
it's an adjustment for a lot of pets. I mean, I think this is totally normal. Like, I'm going to have this in about 2 weeks when my oldest goes to college because he's still home. So they're not quite like alone, but it's not going to be pretty once he goes with them.
But see, they were never like this during the pandemic.
Because we were always there.
I was always here. But tonight, Sammy's trying to get underneath the desk to lick my toes. And Autumn is sitting there and she wants to jump up in my lap and do something.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of, and this is also our time that we're usually out for a big long walk.
Yeah.
We usually do like a 2.5 mile walk in the evening. And they get to play with their friends. So yeah, so it's an adjustment for them, but I think I like being back at work.
There are great, great benefits to being back in the routine and the building and stuff, but there are, you know, some things from the pandemic too that I kind of miss, right? I think, and for a lot of students that are in our population, that the ability to take a break, to be able to just, like, I can walk, I can stand, I can go get something to eat or drink. I can have fidgets. I can lay on the ground, like all these learning styles that help them.
I can fall asleep and nobody will know for a while.
Maybe not that is the positive one, but you know, and the other one is you can just listen for a little bit and then do the work later. Or I had kids that were turning stuff in at like midnight. Like they were able to do stuff on their own time rather, like everyone will do school at 9 a.m. Right. And so
there was a possibility though of kids slipping through the cracks. There was one kid in particular.
Oh, 100%.
Elementary school classroom, and he was staying online even when they returned. And he may or may not have shown up. And, you know, then he'd kind of disappear, and I'd ask him questions. I'd work with him in the back, you know, okay, do you have this worksheet, while the teacher would work with the kids? And he would just disappear. Or he'd nod and say, yeah, I go, okay, turn that in. I'll wait. And it wouldn't come in my little inbox there online. And it was really hard. I couldn't make eye contact. I couldn't go, hey, do you hear me? Do you hear me? He was very, very elusive. He knew how to use it. So that was kind of difficult.
Oh, for sure. I mean, a lot of kids falling through the crack, for sure.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But a lot of them chose to do that. I think I can think of two students that chose to play video games rather than go to school online. And there were multiple attempts to get their attention and to bring them into school, and they just wouldn't do it. So I think some students didn't see the point of doing it because it may have been more difficult for them than people realize. I think it also made people more aware of what some students' lives were.
Oh, yeah. To realize what the home environment is like and all the barriers for the kids that had to take care of their family and they couldn't engage in school, or they would try to and they're like, I have to go take care of my brother. I'll be right back. You know, there's just lots of stuff that was happening in a lot of people's lives for sure.
Right. And I think the same thing happened with other people. I mean, I had teachers who would say, let's talk. And then they'd just break down and they'd start crying. And they were so frustrated because they were having a terrible time with this entire.
That big white.
Rip. What do you call that? This entire predicament, I suppose. And I think that really affected their teaching, but I'm not really sure. I think what it taught me was that I could be flexible and I could cook and I could teach at the same time. And so it allowed me, it was actually, to me, I really enjoyed it because it wasn't, I don't know, I feel like I'm saying something wrong, but it was so less stressful and it was so much easier. And I know other teachers said that they were absolutely stressed out. They couldn't figure out what they were doing. And I just kind of listened to them. And I thought, well, how is that any different than any other lesson plan? I mean, you can't control. You just simply control. You do what you don't, what you can control. And you just let the rest of it go because you're doing the best job that you can. So you can't force them to do what it is that you want them to do. And somebody looked at me and said, yeah, but you don't work with the same number of kids that we do at one time. And I said, well, that's true. However, the same policy is there that you can only accept control over what you can control. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be able to control every single kid, even though you want them there. And maybe that's really frustrating, but just go with the flow and just make it available to them.
There was I would say for me, it was the hardest year of teaching I've ever done. Like it was physically exhausting for me to do it.
How so?
I think one, just the lack of mobility, staring at the screen, like just sitting, and not having that personal interaction, like always being on, like trying to drag it out of the kids a lot. And granted, I work with a group. A lot of my classes were with kids who struggle already. So having those relationship building things that just kind of happen naturally at mm-hmm. school, I can have those hallway talks. I can kind of see like, oh, he's really disengaging. And I can see it happening. All those little interactions and strategies were gone. I didn't have the visual. Because I would just pray they would log in. And if they did, they were a dot. And they would only communicate through typing. So I couldn't get a sense of their humor or their personalities. Or they wouldn't share because they didn't want the whole class to know. Whereas I could, I've already had like probably 5 hallway chats with kids already. But like, hey, I see this. And tell me about blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I could never get those.
Did you ever do breakout rooms with the kids where they would go?
All the time. All the time, right? And it was just so hard. And so I almost felt like and I had a co-teacher too, so like at least like I couldn't even imagine doing this just singular by myself, because there would be times where my other teacher and I, she would keep going on the lesson and I'd be like, okay, I'm gonna take, you know, we take Philip, blink, and then we go into the breakout room and chat, or I'm testing because they didn't come with me the day before with the test, so I didn't understand it, so we're trying to modify it, and, you know, I was just mm-hmm. on all the time. So it was like, it was really, really hard. It was exhausting. And the joys that you usually get from teaching, I think, just weren't there as much. So you were just kind of always feeling not fulfilled. Does that make sense? Like it was super hard.
Because you're not really getting the immediate response because you don't have the facial cues, you don't have the bodily cues, and you don't have the essence of who they are right there giving you that immediate feedback. Even if it's silent, it's still visual.
Yeah. Or knowing like if I was just in person and I could see what you're writing down, I could totally be like, oh, no, you want to do blah, blah, blah. Or no, you keep putting negatives and I really want you to put positives, or, you know, just little things I can see really fast. But if they're only logging in and they're just listening, they're not doing any work, I can't get them to type in the chat. They won't submit stuff through Google Drive. No, you can just see, I can just see them like falling behind and disconnecting, and I, there's nothing, you know, it's just that part was super, super hard for me as an educator.
I kind of looked at it as, let's see what we can do with this. Mm-hmm. How are we going to do this? Because, well, my philosophy is that as a teacher, I'm always learning. Mm-hmm. And this was a huge learning opportunity. And I know a lot of people were frustrated because they didn't know how to do something, but they were terrified to try new and varied things, and they wanted somebody to give them this magic pill.
Yeah.
And they're still in that, they're still kind of in that space. And even in the spring, they were in that space. And I was really amazed because part of me thought, you know, these are ways that are exciting. I think it's wonderful that we get to try something new and innovative and be able to figure out how are we going to be able to reach as many kids as possible. How many people thought of doing something like a flipped learning class where if they recorded it previously and then when they meet with the kids, they can put that there and then they can meet with the kids, and the kids that don't come, they can have that available for them on their right. Canvas page. And then, you know, and open up different times. I know I got a lot of funny faces when I would say, somebody would ask me about a student and I'd say, oh yeah, they should be here this morning because we started texting back and forth at about 3:15 this morning and working on his assignment.
3:15? Both Philip and I are what?
Well, I was awake. I was awake, you know, because I get up early. And I just looked at my phone and I saw that he had texted me and or reminded me. Is that the term?
The Remind app, is that what they were?
Yeah.
They were talking to you that way? Yeah.
Right, because his cell phone service was minimal. And so we just did that. And he was asking me questions about his assignment and everything. And then he was asking me questions that had to do with school and possibly jobs and some other things about his life. So we carried on a full conversation. And my Amazon delivery just came here. I have a busy household, I suppose. Anyway, so I had these conversations with the kids. So it actually allowed me to have a different but still a rich version of what it is that I do with the kids still.
Yeah. There were definite positives for sure. Like it wasn't like a nightmare 24/7. Like the fact that we teachers had to figure out different ways to give tests. And hopefully a lot of those teachers are embracing that. You can do it electronically. You can break it apart. You can put in more ways to get the information, right? Like it kind of forced teachers to find different ways to do assessments. And it made the learning more visual for a lot of our students that wasn't there before, right? They had to go and watch the films, and teachers were doing Google Slides and Nearpods, and it was in some ways more interactive, which I think is a good thing to learn. Like it doesn't always have to be like Scantron hour-long 60-question test. Right?
Really exposed the teachers that weren't really comfortable with technology. I mean, if they weren't going in comfortable, they couldn't get really adapted quick. And if they didn't get adapted, they couldn't really innovate at all. So they were pat with what they had. And like what Tony was talking about, what you're talking about too, you know, if you can play with it, get a little innovative, you know, that's nice. It's not so much a fear of trying something, but there was I imagine a lot of teachers, there's a big fear of failure, just showing up and doing something wrong and class just disappearing. I mean, that's the nightmare of nightmares.
Isn't that bizarre? Because aren't we trying to teach kids that it's okay to fail?
Yeah.
Not to ride over you, Philip. But I like that point that you said, that they are terrified of failing. And how many people can actually sit there and make a mistake in class and say, you know what? I'm sorry. Oops, I did it again.
Ooh,
you know, kind of. Yep, that's what I was thinking. But I mean, you're a person, and you've got to be able to. If your personality that you're giving to your students isn't a true personality, like the true you, if you're putting on some kind of mask, it's not going to stay there. And I think it brought out the real people. I do. I mean, we can go into Pirandello or something like that and talk about the masks that people wear. But if you're not genuine with the students, then, and I think most teachers are, but they just don't want to fail. And they try to overdo. So if somebody says, why don't you try this? Then they want to do that every day. And that can be a nightmare, especially if you have four or five preps.
Right.
And it's like, yeah. So I think another thing that people did not learn, and some people did, was how do you keep it really simple? What's the easiest way to make it simple so that we can do this? What's a creative way? Now, if I were doing this, what is something that I could do? And, you know, when I first started running my own program, I would sit there and I would ask myself that question as I was walking my dogs. And then when I would be in the shower, all of a sudden they would hit me to the point where I would go to work and the secretary would look at me and she'd say, okay, what did the shower say this morning? And I'd say, the shower said, and we would, all of a sudden we'd be on some kind of new thing. But because I think exercise and just doing something that allows you not to think about what it is that you're obsessing with gives you more oversight and makes it less subjective and more objective and kind of opens your brain to being more creative and trying something and making it simple, or even just asking the kids, you know, foreign languages, I'm not really sure, but you know, if you're going to give a test, you just do a Google form and there's a way to present it and it'll lock their screen when they take it and it'll scramble the questions. It'll scramble the answers. Mm-hmm. All these things, and they can't get off of that. So you could always try something like that. And I learned that before we went into lockdown. And so we made use of it in lockdown.
So are you talking about like NetApp, like that program that you could do where it would just lock everything but the one singular screen on their Chromebook?
Well, you can do that with Google Forms.
Yeah.
In quizzes.
Yeah.
If you write a quiz, yeah, there's a whole lot of stuff. And so, you know, but if you keep it really simple, that's fine. If the kids are going to be calling each other and asking each other the questions on the tests, you're not going to be able to prevent that. You do the best job that you can. And you're, believe me, they're going to be two steps ahead of you. So
all the time. Yeah, they're quickety quick. But there are ways to, like, we embraced in the math arena, because there are some really good programs where you, because one of the problems was you just couldn't see their work live. You had to wait, right, until they either did it through like a certain way in Canvas, but like for math, that was kind of hard. But we found a couple programs where you could see their math live, which was great. So you could pull them into a breakout room and be like, I see that you've been on problem number 3 for a while. I'm going to share my screen, or you share your screen and show me, you know, where are you stuck? Right. So I'm not telling them like, oh, the answer's, you know, why or whatever. But you could say like, hey, remember we talked about, you know, what's the slope of a line? And then if they're like, I have no idea, we're like, let's skip this one. Or if they're like, yeah, if they could kind of walk me through it, I'm like, okay, well, I know that they know parts of it. But you could have those discussions and not disturb the rest of the class, which is super hard to do in person. Right. Because I either have to do a completely alternate location, which is hard to do if you're the only teacher in the room. And so there were some ways to kind of embrace those accommodations that a lot of students need. So that was kind of a nice little...
That does reveal the limitations that quizzes present, though, doesn't it? I mean, even under the best of circumstances, they only test a limited amount of knowledge for a very limited amount of time. And the best working knowledge of something, or the best knowledge of something, is a working knowledge of something, obviously. So when Christy puts it on the board and you guys work through it in real time, obviously that is the way we learn. And when you do go out for that run and just take that thing to the side and put it away, that is actually known to be the way to do something. It's recovery from a thought process. And when you do set it aside, you come back to it fresh. That's when the learning process is anew. And you're actually better able to solve the problem when you set it aside. So that's also physiological.
Because if you're not, and if you're not fresh, then how do you expect the kids to like catch on and everything? Right.
Right.
But so here's another thing though. And that is, if you are working with kids on a test, why can you not do a verbal assessment? If a kid is struggling with an assessment, like a mm-hmm. test.
Yeah.
Have them walk you through how that goes. Now, what I used to have my students do was I told them, okay, I'm going to give you a problem and you're going to write it out step by step. And yes, that's going to take a while. But if I give you a word problem, you're going to look at the word problem. You're going to tell me what is the information you need and what is the actual question. And then show me how you're going to use that information and step by step. And mm-hmm. once they started doing that, that they never scored beneath and exceeds on the state tests because they could actually explain how those went. And this is when they had right. to do the written. Right. And so they learned how to process everything. And if you remember when we used to do math, well, at least it was when I was a little guy.
With sticks and bark and dinosaurs. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. And sometimes with bones, you know,
right. Right.
I mean, my brother came in very handy with that. So you had to show the entire process of how you got from 3x plus 4 equals 15.
Yeah, like solving for x, like find the
right. And so you had to figure out the whole thing, and you just did it, and you explained how you did that. And so what we're finding is, at least with the people that I work with, is that kids cannot do that. They can't really explain it. They say, well, because it's supposed to be like that. And it's like, but why?
Right.
And so I think doing the breakout and having the kid explain where they are, because we have so many kids who say, well, I can't do this. Well, what do you mean you can't do it? Well, I don't get it. Well, what don't you get? Well, I don't get how you got this and this. Okay, so let's start at the very beginning. Walk me through where you are. And then you get to that point and you say, okay, now what? And they say, I don't know. And then you say, okay, write this down and da, 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 da. So, and because you want them to have the understanding. And a test is an assessment of how well you've taught what you have. And also it also tests their level of understanding and knowledge. And if they don't have it, that's on both of you. And sometimes it is on the kid, because if the kid's being a little knock-a-do and not really paying attention, then I had to make up something. they have to take some responsibility for that too. But either you make the material interesting, because to me, math is one of the dullest classes. I'm sorry. I know that there's some people who really get off on math, and they salivate over it. I don't know
if salivate's the right word, speaking as a math teacher, but I mean, there are hurdles and barriers for many people to find the relevance, right? So it's finding, how is this going to help you?
Right. And so, you know, we were talking the other day in class, and some of the kids said, well, when am I going to need math? I said, well, if you're a car mechanic, you're going to need to know angles. You're going to need to know if you're going to restore anything, if you're going to be working on repairing something, right. You need to know measurements, and you're going to have to put things together. If you're a carpenter, you have to know angles. You have to know dimensions. There's a lot of stuff you need.
As a paramedic, well, I just want to go into retail? I had put into a bag of, say, 500 milliliters of D5W and deliver how many drops per second, deliver how many milliliters of dose per minute to the patient. And I had to do that calculation in my head real quick and had to be accurate. And I could do it because that was mm-hmm. my profession at the time. And it was pretty involved in mathematics. Now I can't do it, but then... off the top of my head.
Right.
Well, it's really funny, because all of a sudden I have these kids that were studying to become medical assistants. They started coming over to my program from across town to sit down with me to go over their math. Because they had to do that very thing, Philip.
Yep.
Yeah. And they're like, how do I do this? I'm like, okay, let's be creative and let's talk this one out. And we got there. And part of it was just to check back in. But yeah, so that was kind of fun too. If you want to invest your money, if you're doing banking, you have to be able to, I mean, you need the math.
Yeah.
It doesn't work for everybody, but if you're going to do hobbies, you're going to want some geometry. You may want, you know, if you're switching up a recipe that you're cooking, you need algebra.
Yeah.
You're going to have to figure out these things, and you're going to need geometry because how much volume are you going to use in this cake pan and how much are you actually creating? You're also using chemistry when you're cooking as well. So there's some science.
Yeah. It's everywhere, right? Like it's the time management and how much am I going to make if I'm saving for the, I mean, there's lots of it. Is every kid going to have to plot Y equals MX plus B all the time, every day? No. But I mean, a lot of it is that how to solve, you know, when you go into Home Depot, you got to figure out how much is it going to cost for me to get, you know, so much carpet and I want a budget. And if this one's on sale, you got to figure percentages. No one gives you a word problem, then you solve it, right? Like you have to figure it out. So those are those kind of real world problems that, you know, I always am excited to share with my class.
But I think that the pandemic allowed us extra time because for a lot of the teachers that I know, they would be on for 20 minutes and then the kids would have work time. And they could be there available for the kids if the kids needed something. And then they would pop back in and then they would answer questions and or what other things are happening. And if a kid wanted to be in a breakout room, they could do that as well. So I think it actually allowed for far more opportunities and probably in a more relaxed state for the students because not everybody is staring at them.
Yeah, for teachers or for students to get help from their teachers in a kind of a low stress way. The pandemic was able to, if you were willing to advocate and ask the teacher, right? Like through the chat or through an email, hey, can I, or just you could pop into the office hours, right? And so you were able to access help from teachers, I think in a little bit low stress, more approachable way. I think that's something that I hope teachers can somehow create or replicate.
Right. And what I also found is that if, at least when I'm teaching math, is that I provide other resources that teach the same thing. So maybe there's some YouTube videos, maybe there's a Khan Academy, or I might ask another kid who seems to be getting it, can you explain this concept in your terms? Because my language doesn't seem to be being translated. And then they will say exactly what I just said. But the stress level or the anxiety level on the other students goes down when they say it. And all of a sudden, it just snaps right in and they're able to listen to that as well.
Right.
So I think having personal and extra resources on the side, maybe it's a link to a page that just kind of lays it out and explains it. Maybe if you do like a Nearpod or a, what's the other thing that we used? Nearpod and...
We did Padlet. A lot of people did Pear Deck.
Yeah. Yeah. All these different things that you can use and, you know, just use those and just make the concept there so that it's like basic and for review. And then you can get into the more advanced stages. So you teach somebody how to draw a face with the egg-shaped head and then the two lines for the neck. Well, once they get that concept, then you can add more things and then they can tweak it and start adding a bit more. Some people just don't have that artistic flair and it looks more like Picasso on drugs. And other people
Picasso
might...
was drugs. Remember, he said that. I am drugs.
Or, you know, or maybe it looks something more like a Pollock or even, except that sounds violent with a head. Or you're doing something, you know, like maybe a Cezanne or a Degas. So, or even a Whistler. But
oh my God. So the point is.
The point is once you teach the basics, then you see where the kids can go. And you give them that opportunity to advance themselves.
Right. Yes. You're naming 27,000 artists.
I'm sorry.
One more. I do think, and I hope that teachers embrace the kids Charles having Schultz. access to the notes and the lectures, right? Like they had them on their Canvas page. So you could always, because we had to, right? If a kid was absent or even now, like we need to have kids who are quarantining, they need to be able to, right? So teachers are just uploading everything and right. having it are on their pages, which is great.
Are they uploading like a brief statement that's something that the kids can listen to? Because kids are so audio visual. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily reading your notes, because nothing could be duller.
Right.
But it's kind of like, or even doing a Screencastify where you show how to do the basic problem and you're explaining that as you're doing it.
Yeah. We did both. And I know like some of the science teachers, they were, you know, remember like at the beginning of the pandemic, they were sharing like, here's what this teacher's doing. They would kind of like mm-hmm. rally all the troops kind of thing. But I know like for my classes, we would videotape the lesson, like videotape the notes, here's how you do it. And we'd upload that. And then we would take a PDF of all of our notes and just have that there. So then if you wanted to see how we solve the problem, you would have that. And if you just was like, God, I'm missing something. I just need to see like the finished product. Where did I go? Where did I drop a negative or something? And so they had, mm-hmm. we've got both versions for every single day of school that we did in our class. So we have that available. I mean, it only works if you're going to teach the same thing. Like if yeah, you're changing things, you got to adapt it. But I think, you know, I know the science teachers were doing that. The art teachers were uploading stuff that you could do. Go research this, see these visual examples. I just think there's lots of ways that the kids are so tech savvy that it'll help them. At least I'm hoping.
Have you ever thought about doing, you know, those pictures that you can, you know, find the five differences?
Yeah. I love those.
Have you ever thought about giving the kids a problem and saying, find the five mistakes?
Yeah. Our math teacher a couple years ago who retired, that was one of her test problems. She would do a full test problem and you had to find why did I get the wrong answer? And you had to figure out what it was. And I think one of our science teachers, the same kind of thing. Here's my whole mm-hmm. thesis statement or here's how I solved the lab and I didn't get the answer right. What did I do wrong? Can you find the error? Because you have to know all of it, right? To be able to figure out what's not working.
Right. And I think that if you could do that in breakout rooms where you have two people mm-hmm. working together or even three in a group, that they can collectively look at that and start yeah. breaking it down. And then maybe they can come up with some of them on their own using the same concept.
Right.
And that's where they're actually putting it in practice and they're using it. And then it would still, it should stick on their cerebral Velcro much better. Because yeah. if they have to explain something and they have to discuss it, then yeah, it's there. And it, you know, sometimes there's too much olive oil on the Velcro, but it'll come back.
Olive oil on the Velcro. Okay. Philip, were there other things that you saw on your end that you're kind of like, want to chime in? I feel like I'm talking a lot.
Yeah, you are. Philip? Are you there?
No, I'm here. The pandemic it's still going on. There's probably an episode 2 here soon. I don't know if it'll be sending people home.
Yeah, well, the kids are very adaptable, and I think that they have an incredible amount of grit. Mm. And I think that they're looking for... I was trying to figure out, how do you create something that would be learning like a video game? And then I thought, you know, there's even fatigue from that.
Yeah, a lot of fatigue.
And I think that they need something that's varied. I think we all do. You can't just put on an Elton John album after Elton John album after Elton John album after Elton John album. I know that there are some people who are just deliriously loving it, but for most people, we need to have a little bit of variety.
Yeah.
Especially as we get older. But I believe that kids need to have different kinds of stimuli that are coming at them. to challenge them in different ways. And 3 hours on the computer is actually, I think that is the trigger point for depression.
Ouch.
So,
And
so I,
oh no.
Well, when we had them on there for 6 hours and people were complaining, I'm thinking, you know, hold on a second, because the data shows that they shouldn't be on there for that amount of time anyway. Mm-hmm. So, and you're talking about their mental health, their mental, everything else. And somebody said, yeah, but they're on their phones. And I said, okay, so they're on there for even longer. And we're talking about anxiety and depression with the kids. And we've had the highest suicide rates over the pandemic. And so I think doing the SEL work was excellent for that time. I don't know whether or not teachers are still doing some SEL work. I remember 15 years ago that there was a teacher in our building who used to do SEL work before every class. And people mocked her. And they thought, oh, she's so new age and da-da-da-da-da. And just the other day, I was walking my dogs in a park, and I bumped into her. And I thought, oh, my gosh. And she was just so happy and carefree. And it took me a while to remember who she was because she was so familiar. And I didn't want to say anything because I couldn't remember her name. But I mentioned it to somebody, and they said, oh, yeah. And I said, do you remember how she used to do what we now call SEL in all of her classes? And people said, oh, my gosh, yeah, she was ahead of her time. Mm-hmm. And she was right, because it helps with the brain function anyway. And I think just doing some of that square breathing, because that happened today at work, and just kind of doing some visions, and I don't mean visions like mushroom visions. I mean visions like just seeing yourself in a calm place and just kind of grounding yourself. I think that that really does help a lot of students and puts them there, because it might be you're taking three steps back to make one giant leap forward when you're going to be working with them. And it doesn't hurt to do that maybe 2-3 times during a period if you have an overly long period too, because that's a very long time to have to listen to one person.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot. And just be sitting and not moving, and yes.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So wrapping up, what would either of you like to maybe put in a few bon mots? That's French for good words.
I knew that.
That's why I'm positive.
I taught you something.
I understand French. Yay. And I was in France and about in 2016, and I began to speak French, and I was told within, oh, mere words, please don't. And they began to speak English to me.
Oh.
Said, thank you.
Really? They Where were you?
I went to
in what,
Normandy.
Where were you?
I went to Normandy. I went to the battlefields, and before I went to Paris and Amsterdam anyway. And I was trying to muster up the best French I could, thinking I didn't want to just come off with English and be rude. And as I started to speak French, he goes, oh no.
Was it Pepe Le Pew French?
He says, I speak English. It was my French, what? It was terrible French. My French is awful.
Was it Pepe Le Pew French? Was it, hello, comment ça va?
There was no caricature behind
what it. What I found...
Bad French.
Well, what I found, actually, when I was in Paris, because I was told the Parisians were awful people, and I thought, okay, fine, well, I'll deal with it. And I got there, and everybody I spoke to, because I would say, parlez-vous anglais? And they'd say, non. And I'd say, okay, fine, because my French is terrible. So you're going to have to listen to me. And then they would say, no, your French is wonderful. It's charming. And then they would talk to me. And then they would help me out. It was. Wow. I had an incredibly one. It was the Americans who were the pigs. So it was just the opposite. But when I was in the small villages, that was when I ran into the problems.
No, they loved me. I mean, they just as soon as I started speaking the terrible French, they said, "It's okay, I'll speak English. Thank you." So I said, "Thank you." You don't want to hear my French anymore. It's terrible. But,
But see, that there's an example of willingness to fail.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you were trying.
Yeah. Because when you're in a foreign country, believe me, like when I moved to South America, that was terrifying, and I had to learn how to do it, but I did it through pantomime and charades, and just the people around me just taught me. So that was wonderful. And then I was sitting down talking to a cab driver as we were driving into the city from my condo, and another teacher who was fluent sat behind me, and he said, "What are you guys talking about?" And I told him, and he said, "How do you know how to have a conversation about that topic?" And I said, "What do you mean?" "Because I'm an adult." And he said, no. "How did your Spanish become that good?" And I said, "Oh, the cab drivers and everybody I meet teach me."
And yeah, my students immersion, teach me. Right?
I mean, yeah, exactly. And so because there were teachers who were unwilling to fail, who are absolutely, and it's the same thing that we were talking about with the pandemic, the teachers who were so worried about everything and weren't just allowing themselves to relax into it and see what the potential and the possibilities were, who just could not learn Spanish. And they stayed down there for several years, and they never did really learn the Spanish, because I got reports back after I'd left. Huh. They had a terrible time. So, with the language. But, you know. Anyway, with all of that, let's just say we will see you all on the next show. And it's been a privilege and an honor to spend time with you both today. Thank you.